Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes of news and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available for download and broadcast on www.tackletaxhavens.com and also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net. Here's a quick news roundup for this month. There's been a revolution in Ukraine. Corrupt President Yanukovych has fled to Russia, and the West is imposing sanctions that are barely tickling the Kremlin. There's apparently only $500,000 left in the Ukrainian state treasury. Ukraine's new finance minister says in the last 3 years, $70 billion was paid out into offshore accounts. We'll have more on all that and the threat of offshore to global security later. TaxCast listeners will know Apple, Google, Microsoft and Cisco Systems have got hundreds of billions of dollars stashed offshore to avoid tax. Now it turns out that not only is the US being deprived of their tax dollars, US taxpayers are actually paying them huge amounts of interest. That's because these household name corporations have invested $163 billion in US government debt. You can check out that story on thebureauinvestigates.com. Also in the US, another go at tackling the secrecy jurisdictions of Delaware, Nevada and Wyoming. Senator Levin's apparently dusting off a bill to try once again to outlaw anonymous shell corporations. Hopes are a bit higher this time round, and the bill may get to the first stage in the summer. Last month, the TaxCast covered the broke tax haven of the Bahamas trying to dig itself out of serious economic crisis, not by ensuring the wealthiest residents actually pay the few taxes that exist for them there, but by hitting the poorest people disproportionately with a regressive value-added tax. Now, Bahamians discover the government official supposed to be implementing it is himself a tax dodger. He owes $100,000 in property tax going back 20 years. After some delays and renegotiations, the European Parliament's finally voted overwhelmingly to end secret ownership of companies and create public registers. But the game's far from over. We'll have more on that later. More countries in the global south are demanding fairer revenues from corporations exploiting their natural resources. This month, Niger, one of the world's largest uranium producers, is having a face-off with French state-owned company Areva. Zimbabwe's government claimed this month it had rather halt all diamond mining than let firms continue fleecing the country of millions. And in the Philippines, 19 mining and oil companies have agreed to go public on the tax they pay and the tax credits they're getting there. Remember the French minister with a secret Swiss bank account? Well, it seems Monsieur Cahuzac also hid $2 million in the Isle of Man. He may face up to 5 years in prison. And finally, the Tax Justice Network's got a brand shiny new app, so you can follow all the latest blogs, news and analysis, and listen to the TaxCast there too, of course. All you've got to do is just search for Tax Justice Network on Google Play Store. And yes, the mega tax avoider Google irony is not lost on us. Those are the headlines. Now we're going to talk to the Tax Justice Network's John Christensen for his take on this month. Okay, John, let's start this month in Europe. European members of Parliament have toughened up the anti-money laundering directive by voting for public registries on company ownership, which is great news, although the proof will be in the pudding, won't it? Because the UK is already busy trying to exempt trusts from a public register. Now, there's also been some progress over the European Union Savings Tax Directive, hasn't there? So tell us what it is and what progress we're seeing there.
Well, the Savings Tax Directive, when it first came in 2005, was a pretty weak mechanism because although it provided for multilateral automatic information exchange between member states, it didn't cover quite a range of incomes and it only applied to ordinary people. And since the vast majority of high-level tax evaders in Europe tend to use offshore trusts and offshore companies and stuff like that, very sophisticated structures, they weren't captured by the original directive. And the reason they weren't covered was because of extraordinarily high levels of lobbying by countries like Austria and Luxembourg and United Kingdom to try to exclude these trusts and offshore foundations from the original directive. Now, for quite a long time, Europe has been trying to strengthen the directive, but Austria and Luxembourg in particular have been holding out. What appears to be happening now is that Austria and Luxembourg, under huge pressure from other member states, are going to concede. In fact, the message coming out of Austria is that they will concede at a meeting later this month. Luxembourg, increasingly isolated politically, is likely to accede as well. So we might be moving to a position where Commissioner Semeta, who's responsible for tax affairs within Europe, will be able to announce by the end of this month that the savings tax directive will be upgraded and the new directive will come into force in 2016. So this is a very, very promising step indeed. And the interesting thing, of course, is that the savings tax directive pretty much it's aligned with what the OECD is trying to do with its own automatic information exchange standard. So what we're seeing now is the emergence of a genuine international standard for automatic information exchange, with the European Union applying that as early as 2016.
Quite fast movement after such a long time plugging away there.
Yes, there's been a great deal of resistance. Of course, behind the scenes, there's huge lobbying. We know that the legal profession in Britain is still pushing really hard to prevent trusts from being included. And if that happens, if trusts are excluded from the revised savings tax directive, then, needless to say, the high-level evaders will be rushing to establish offshore trusts as quickly as possible, and there'll be a massive barn door through which they can escape. But if public pressure is kept at the current level, then maybe we'll see political movement in the right direction.
Okay, so that's promising news. Let's talk about the IMF now. They've surprised us all recently, haven't they, by some research they've done showing that, surprise, surprise, inequality leads to slower economic growth. And we've had a really amazing comment from the IMF's deputy research director saying, a more redistributive tax system appears to lead to higher growth. So it's a bit of an about turn for the IMF, isn't it? It seems to be that they are for tax justice all of a sudden.
Wonderful news from the IMF, a massive reversal. Throughout my career as an economist, I've heard economists argue that redistribution harms growth because it reduces incentives. In other words, if you take money away from the rich and give money to the poor won't have the incentive to go out and work. And at the same time, the rich won't have the incentive to go and invest their accumulated savings into new productive activity. And this has always been very questionable. There's been very little empirical support for this suggestion. Now the IMF has come out with research saying that actually, the evidence suggests that inequality is not only harming sustainability of economies, partly because, of course, as a result of inequality, more households are having to use more debt, and that's harming the quality of growth. But now, and this is the really important point, the IMF are saying that there is no evidence whatsoever that redistribution actually harms the quality of growth. In fact, countries which have been redistributing very strongly have a better quality of growth than countries that aren't redistributing. And now the IMF have come forward and said, yes, so we're beginning to see a really important debate emerging now around inequality and wealth distribution.
That's great news. Now, let's talk about Niger. Until now, the state-owned French nuclear energy company Areva was doing pretty well over there. It would quite like to carry on that way, wouldn't it? But Niger's government wants a better deal now. And Niger, it turns out, has not benefited at all from decades of uranium mining. Now, the French company Areva was enjoying all sorts of tax breaks and tax holidays, while French people at the same time were getting some of the lowest energy prices in Europe.
Well, this is a shocking story, and in some respects it's good to have a focus now on some of the big European companies working in former European colonies. Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. 40% of its state budget comes from overseas aid, and worse, it has one of the poorest tax to GDP ratios in the whole of Africa, and yet it has some of the biggest and most important uranium ore sources in the world. So what's been going on here? Well, Areva has been mining ore for about 40 years. Every 10 years when they negotiate a fresh contract, they get extraordinary contractual terms. 2004, the last time they contracted, they were completely exempted from export duties on their uranium outputs. They're exempt from customs duties, value-added taxes on all the materials and equipment they use. They had a stability clause so that any increase in royalty tax under the 2006 law didn't affect them. This is a case of David and Goliath struggle. And, of course, Areva is supported by all the weight of the French state. The Nigerian government is now holding out for a better deal. They're pushing for the royalty rate to increase to at least 12%. And there is, needless to say, quite a battle going on between the Nigerian government and the French government. And the French government at this stage appears still to be playing hardball.
So colonialism rules still.
Colonialism rules still, and it's particularly shameful that France is playing such a hard game with one of the world's poorest countries.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. For years, the Tax Justice Network's been warning that offshore infrastructure is a threat to national and global security. Now, unfortunately, events in Ukraine are demonstrating exactly how true that is. This month, the TaxCast looks at looting by Ukrainian and Russian elites. Where does the corruption begin and end? And how does it affect global stability? There's been a revolution in Ukraine. The spectacularly corrupt President Yanukovych has fled the country to Russia. Crimea's now become the focus of international attention. And there's a confrontation nobody wanted between Russia and the West. The threat of war and further violence and oppression hangs over citizens across the region. One thing most Ukrainians would agree on was that their president was deeply corrupt. Here's a Ukrainian protester.
What is wrong in Ukraine? Why we want a revolution? The government is against people. These are Ukrainian people. Why we want revolution? I'm sorry about it's a guess. Do you know what is corruption? You don't know what is corruption. We are just get oppressed and, you know, killed and beaten by our government. We don't want this shit going on in our country.
After Ukrainian President Yanukovych fled the country, volunteer divers rescued hundreds of documents dumped in a lake next to one of his opulent residences. A collective of journalists are occupying one of them, where they're drying them all out, scanning them, and putting them online. They've also recovered 200 folders of documents from his compound. They read like a who's who of the world's tax havens. I spoke to journalist and author Ben Judah. The connection's not great. He's there reporting on the situation in Ukraine.
I'm speaking to you right now from Kiev, and Kiev has been the site of a dramatic revolution that's taken place over the past few months that has now turned into a Russian invasion of Crimea. And when I've been speaking over the past few days to opposition activists and speaking to bloggers and Ukrainian opposition, liberal, democratic politicians whose greatest aspiration is for Ukraine to join the European Union, what do you think they say? And in fact, what they say is that over the past few years, it's become clear to them, and they've been shocked by it, that the money being stolen from their countries is going into European tax havens. And this is increasingly making them think that Western European bankers and lawyers and management consultants that are helping these Ukrainian elites make the transfers of wealth into these tax havens, this has led them to be disappointed with the West, seeing the West is hypocritical, and become somewhat anti-Western. And in the long run, if this continues, we face the risk of the Ukrainian and the Russian opposition coming to see Britain in particular as the money launderer of Vladimir Putin and responsible for the plunder of their countries.
Right now, journalists around the world are accessing the Yanukovych documents and working on stories that involve anonymous company structures registered in the British Virgin Islands, Dutch Antilles, Liechtenstein, Austria, Panama, Britain, and many more. Yanukovych's palace compound was one-third owned by an anonymous UK shell company and two-thirds owned by an Austrian bank. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But how about Russian money and the special relationship with London? Journalist and author of The Last Man in Russia, Oliver Bullough.
Russia's gone to being the least equal large country in the world in just over two decades. It's approximately 100 people who own about 35% of the country. A small number of people have got unimaginably wealthy. And the UK is complicit because we've provided the financial infrastructure that's allowed this to happen. This is the pipelines, as it were, for all this liquid capital to flow out of Russia.
Now, bear in mind, Russia's own central bank calculated back in 2012 that most of the $56 billion exiting that year may be linked to illegal activities. Just how much London banks, lawyers and accountants are making from Russian clients isn't clear. The British Bankers Association says it doesn't have figures on it. If you're an extremely wealthy person, corrupt politician or oligarch, there's no undignified immigration process for you. The UK offers Tier 1 investor visas. Russians are the largest takers. Putin doesn't like any of this, of course. He's been putting all sorts of pressure on members of his elites and politicians to stop stashing their money in Western tax havens and bring it back to Russia. This offshored money might make Russia vulnerable to Western pressures. But he doesn't seem too worried about the sanctions many of the countries opposing Russian involvement in Ukraine have now put in place, as US President Barack Obama explains here.
This morning, I signed an executive order that authorizes sanctions on individuals and entities responsible for violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine or for stealing the assets of the Ukrainian people. According to my guidance, the State Department has also put in place restrictions on the travel of certain individuals and officials. These decisions continue our efforts to impose a cost on Russia and those responsible for the situation in Crimea. We took these steps in close coordination with our European allies. I am confident that we are moving forward together, united in our determination to oppose actions that violate international law and to support the government and people of Ukraine.
The US president may want to talk up international unity, but it's anything but. Apart from the fact that Europe's Russia's number one trading partner, offshore interests are also a block to meaningful action. Because corruption's flowing in all directions. Many of the countries claiming to be shocked to learn of the levels of corruption by the former Ukrainian president are the same ones hosting the infrastructure of banking secrecy that facilitated his looting, the same countries facilitating theft by Russian elites. Oliver Bullough.
Sadly, at the moment, since the West is prepared to compromise and prostitute its values in exchange for vast amounts of money that people have earned over the last 20 years, then there's no reason to listen to the West because everyone knows it's just words. This is a very dangerous situation, what's happening in Ukraine. You know, it is very important that the West is firm in its response to that. And if that involves costing some banks in London some money, then so be it. It's tough, but they're not doing too badly, so I think they can probably afford it.
But it's clear that the power of London's finance sector on the British government is strong enough to ensure no sanctions that will affect their business are likely to happen. Remember, the ruling Conservative Party gets 51% of its funding from the City of London's finance sector. Recently, a sharp-eyed journalist photographed a document in the hands of an official on his way to a government meeting on the Ukraine crisis. The document proposes Britain should, quote, not support, for now, trade sanctions or close London's financial centre to Russians. Close quote. Oliver Bullough again.
I don't think people have realised to what extent the British elite has been corrupted by the money that's come from the former Soviet Union. You just have to look at British politicians and European politicians who have been prepared to go on the Kremlin's payroll. They see absolutely nothing wrong with accepting money from people who abuse their own citizens and their own societies. Gerhard Schroeder ceased being Chancellor of Germany and 3 months later went to work for a Gazprom subsidiary. I mean, he was literally on the Kremlin payroll. Tony Blair, though he hasn't worked for the Kremlin, is working for, I don't know if he still is, for the government of Kazakhstan. Peter Mandelson has done work for the government in Azerbaijan. All of these are resource-rich former Soviet countries. Look at the party on Oleg Deripaska's yacht that was attended by both Peter Mandelson when he was an EU commissioner and George Osborne when he was the shadow chancellor. This money is very attractive to people from the political class. There are lots of people who have been prepared to lobby for oligarchs in exchange for cash.
Back in 2006, when one of Russia's largest state energy companies, Rosneft, floated shares on the London Stock Exchange, raising $11 billion, there were no concerns. Yet, says Oliver Bullough, there should have been.
I don't think it should be allowed to float in London. Its largest and most profitable assets had just 2 years previously been confiscated in an extremely murky process from Mikhail Khodorkovsky, an oligarch who had fallen out with Putin. Now, Khodorkovsky had himself obtained the assets in a very murky way just a few years before, but the point is that essentially these assets had been expropriated without any due process from a private owner, nationalised and then re-privatised again on the London Stock Exchange. London provided the mechanism whereby the Russian government could cash out of an asset that it had effectively just taken away from its private owner just 2 years previously. And the lack of concern about that in British institutions did mean that the Russian officials who'd done this could get extremely wealthy.
70 Russian companies are currently listed on the London Stock Exchange. Just as a point of comparison, New York's Stock Exchange has only got two. Russian and former Soviet states have raised over $82 billion in London in the last two decades. It's the new special relationship. Londongrad is open for business. No questions asked. Champagne all round. So you can see why Russia's not too worried about the West. Because the West is clearly all about making money, even in the face of criminality, looting, violations of international law, occupation of sovereign territory, oppression and killing. The financial interests of Russian elites are their greatest vulnerability. But the City of London will do their best to ensure they'll never get hit where it really hurts. And because of the secretive financial structures available to oligarchs and thieves alike in these jurisdictions worldwide, how do we even know where those assets are? Journalist and author of Treasure Islands, Nick Shaxson.
Raising global standards on transparency of ownership of corporate vehicles and trusts and so on is a very powerful way forward. And this is an area where you could have an incredible sort of impact on a huge range of different countries with troubled governments. One could put some serious pressure on Putin on his own power structures. If his own power structures start to hurt, then you'd have trouble.
There are moves in Europe towards creating public registers of the real owners of companies. But guess what? The UK wants to exclude trusts. Another thing that would really hurt Russia is restrict access of Russian banks to the Western financial system. Now fast forward to China and the new role the City of London's about to play.
In 2012, the British government signed a deal with China for the City of London to become the premier non-Asian trading hub for offshore renminbi. And the City of London is absolutely thrilled at this prospect. They see huge potential here. Obviously, China's a massive market. And this does raise concerns because given the incredible hold that the City of London has over the British government, it would be very easy for the Chinese to use this as a political weapon in future if it wants, or a political lever in any rate, threatening to reduce London's role and, you know, give more business to other rival financial centres and so on. So it is a matter for concern.
So what do Western governments have to say to people really in Ukraine, in Crimea, in Russia, in China? Sorry, we could do more, but we're making too much money. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back on The Taxcast next month.